The Writer Files, a member of the Podglomerate Network. I want to mention a great resource for writers, and this month's sponsor, Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow, a DIY manual for the construction of stories. I'll expound later in the show, but the short version is this long-awaited book about the craft of creative writing from New York Times bestselling author Steve Almond sets out to debunk the well-meaning but misguided myths that hold us back from writing our deepest and most honest work. Pick up a copy today of Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow, wherever you buy books, more soon. Greetings, scribes. I have got some exciting news to share. The Writer Files now has an exclusive Patreon community where subscribers will get exclusive access to uncut ad-free interviews, a writer's happy hour, bonus breakdowns, and content from productivity and publishing experts each month. In the meantime, just head over to patreon.com/thewriterfiles. It's free to join Patreon to get a preview, and you can upgrade anytime. That's patreon.com/thewriterfiles. Help us start something special.
And then I got really interested in narrative journalism and discovered that all of my interest in storytelling and poetry could be translated into a journalistic format. So I became a writer for magazines and became an editor of a magazine that served the Intermountain West here in Utah. And absolutely loved it. Was, you know, really sort of felt as though I had found my calling in many ways, and I could work with writers. And I sort of had this fantasy of being the next Malcolm Gladwell, you know? And then it all fell apart. In 2009, the magazine I worked for just didn't have enough money. And one day we all got hustled into an office and we were told that the magazine was closing that day. Pack up your stuff. Thanks for giving it a good go. And that was it. And that is when the shit hit the fan, so to speak, that prompted what turned into a memoir.
And welcome back to The Writer Files. I am still your humble host, Kelton Reed, wishing you pages, patience, and perseverance per usual. Critically acclaimed memoirist Melissa Bond spoke to me about her dark night of the soul, crowdfunding her lauded memoir and the paperback release of Blood Orange Night, a memoir of insomnia, motherhood, and benzos. Melissa's a narrative journalist, editor, and award-winning poet whose breakout debut memoir, Blood Orange Night, is a Barnes & Noble nonfiction book of the month and was selected by the New York Times as one of the best audiobooks of 2022. Publishers Weekly said of the book, "In this raw and captivating debut, journalist Bond chronicles her volatile descent into benzodiazepine addiction. Bond's narrative casts a burning light under the hazards of overprescribing and the threat it poses to vulnerable people." And Melissa blogged and became a regular contributor for Mad in America in the years of her dependence on benzodiazepines. She's a respected speaker and writer in the perils of overprescribing, has been featured on podcasts, including the New York Times Book Review and others. In this file, Melissa and I discussed her guerrilla street poet poverty phase and hosting national poetry slams, why she never imagined writing a memoir, how she kickstarted her hit book in just 3 days, the transformative process of finding gems in the rubble of difficult times, her process, meditation practice, and sitting beyond oneself, how to quiet the gnome of self-doubt, and a lot more. Stay calm and write on. And don't forget, you can always support this show by heading to writerfiles.fm, where you can also sign up for email updates and other resources for writers. And if you're a fan of The Writer Files, please click follow to automatically see new interviews in your podcatcher as soon as they're published, and drop us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you tune in to help other writers find us. We are back on The Writer Files, and I'm honored today to be joined by an esteemed guest. I've got critically acclaimed memoirist Melissa Bond is hanging out with us, and obviously you're much more than that, but we can start there and then talk about all things writing. Can't wait to pick your brain today.
Yeah, I'm super excited to be here.
Well, you have had a really fascinating journey to this incredibly harrowing and critically lauded memoir, Blood Orange Night, a memoir of insomnia, motherhood, and benzos. And of course, I think your original subtitle was a little bit different than that. And I would love for you to take us back. And I know, you know, obviously, the book itself is a testament to kind of what you have been through that kind of generated this incredible piece of self-reporting and journalism and so much more than that. But take us back a little bit, because obviously prior to the memoir, you had had this kind of very interesting career as not only a journalist, but a poet and, you know, kind of immersed in the writing life. But yeah, take us back prior to the memoir and just kind of, as we do with so many authors, give us a little kind of cliffs of your superhero origins.
I like that. So pre-memoir and pre kind of life Fukushima, which resulted in the memoir, I was living like sort of my 20s were that like kind of very unromantic but glamorized poet poverty phase, you know, where I wrote a ton. I hosted the poetry slams here in Salt Lake City. I did tons and tons of like guerrilla street poetry. And everything for me at that stage was about, you know, getting my art out there. But I felt somehow as though, you know, and a lot of writers may go through this. I think I went through a really intense phase where I felt as though if I tried to sell my own work with too much vigor, somehow it was a soul death, that I was, you know, sacrificing the virtues of my art to, you know, commodification. And so that, hence the poet poverty. But it was a fun life. You know, I traveled a ton. I went to New Orleans after Katrina and did a whole project there. And I was always traveling and writing about the stuff that I saw while I was traveling, and a lot of, you know, deep internal musing. And then I got really interested in narrative journalism and discovered that all of my interest in storytelling and poetry could be translated into a journalistic format. So I became a writer for magazines and became an editor of a magazine that served the Intermountain West here in Utah, and absolutely loved it. It was, you know, really sort of felt as though I had found my calling in many ways, and I could work with writers, and I sort of had this fantasy of being the next Malcolm Gladwell, you know? And then it all fell apart in 2009. So the recession hit Utah a little later. The magazine I worked for just didn't have enough money. And one day we all got hustled into an office and we were told that the magazine was closing that day. Pack up your stuff. Thanks for giving it a good go. And that was it. And that is when the shit hit the fan, so to speak, that prompted what turned into a memoir.
Amazing, amazing. Yeah, what a harrowing time for a lot of journalists. And of course, you experienced it firsthand, like so many authors on this show that I've spoken with about that particular time in history, that implosion, so to speak, of the industry. And of course, the memoir speaks for itself, but I'd love to talk about not necessarily the writing of the book itself, but kind of the journey then once the book was finished, and you know, not even once the book was finished, but kind of I'd love to talk about kind of the inception of not only the Kickstarter that you funded to do the work, but then kind of that reception once it had, you know, gotten out to the world and people were like, whoa.
Right. Let's see, 2015, I got divorced. You know, at that point I had two little kids, one with special needs. So I had been doing the kind of stay-at-home mom, thinking I was going to be the stay-at-home mom, artist, writer, mama, but then had this health crisis hit that was prompted by medications prescribed by my doctor, which is what the book is about. And with the divorce, there was suddenly this question of how am I going to make a living? I mean, so many writers face that, you know. I didn't want to teach. The magazine industry in Salt Lake City was not sufficient to be able to support kids, really. I mean, it was good when I was in the poet poverty phase, but It didn't buy, you know, good shoes every year. And so I was unemployed, had no idea what direction I was going to go. I was applying for jobs, and I thought, you know, I can live really, really, really cheaply. I'm going to live with friends for a year, and I'm going to fund the writing of this book via a Kickstarter that will give me just enough to have about 10 months. And my goal was to finish the first draft of the book in that time. And so, you know, and I don't know if I've seen prior to that a book that had not yet been written. It was just the promise of a book that was up for a Kickstarter, but I decided to go for it, and I gave it everything I got, and the Kickstarter funded in 3 days, went over what I had hoped it would go to, and gave me 10 months, and I finished the first draft in literally in that amount of time.
Amazing. Earlier in the show, I mentioned an invaluable resource for writers. Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow, a DIY manual for the construction of stories based on 3 decades of writing, failing, and trying again. Author Steve Almond is a beloved professor at Harvard and Wesleyan and the acclaimed New York Times bestseller of 12 books of fiction and nonfiction. And in Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow, Steve employs the radical empathy he displayed as a co-host of the Dear Sugars podcast with Cheryl Strayed, where they explored the joys and trials of storytelling to explode myths that hold us back from writing our deepest and truest work. The book includes chapters on plot, character, and chronology, but travels far beyond the earnest intentions of most craft books. It also includes writing prompts to generate new work. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Richard Russo called it one of the best books on writing he's ever read, and also the funniest. Pick up a copy of Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow, a DIY manual for the construction of stories wherever you buy books, and add it to your TBR today. And just a quick aside to revisit the exclusive Writer Files Patreon community, where subscribers get access to uncut ad-free interviews, a writer's happy hour, bonus breakdowns, and a lot more. I know that for serious writers, it can be more distracting than ever to cut through the noise, stay productive, and home in on what's happening in the publishing industry. Over 8 years, we've provided a looking glass into the habits of professional writers and publishing industry insiders. And as your humble host, I've decided to launch a membership-based Patreon for serious scribes to cut through the noise, swap tips and tricks, and hang out with like-minded peers. Just head over to patreon.com/thewriterfiles for bonus writing resources, monthly episode breakdowns, writer's happy hour, a community of your peers, ad-free episodes, and more. It's free to join. To get a preview, and you can upgrade anytime, that's patreon.com/thewriterfiles. Help us start something cool and special. Keep calm and write on. That's such an inspiring story. I mean, such an inspiring story. And of course, the result, Blood Orange Night. Yeah, it kind of gives me chills to think about it. And you know, it's been described so often as like this propulsive cautionary page turner. And of course, you live through it. So writing about it, it seems, must have been somewhat cathartic for you.
Yeah, I would say it was a way of, I think a lot of times for me, when I write, it's a way of digging deeper into the well and sifting through and finding, trying to understand the world around me, to understand what had happened to me in these kind of series of traumas. And also, I think it's a transformative process, because there was a way of really finding the gems of the experience, which is hard to speak for when you have a real severe trauma. But for me, the process became this sort of transformational exercise in really finding the beauty and really witnessing myself as a character that had gone through some radically difficult times of like near death, you know, stroke, and seeing myself as a character gave me that distance to be able to really pull out some of the magic that happened, you know, in the survival aspect of it.
Yeah, that is really fascinating. And yeah, congratulations on the reception, of course, and now out in paperback, which must be really kind of feel like a testament to what you've been through. I mean, Are you breathing a little bit of a kind of a sigh of relief now, or what's the vibe over there these days?
Oh, it's like triumphant. Not only did I survive, but I was able to, just put my heart and soul into something as a way to, for me, what really drove the writing of the book was to try to make something of the experience, but also to really spare anyone else, or, if I could, from going through what I had been through. And it wasn't just an exercise in trying to get the information out there. I wanted to create something that was of real beauty, that was evocative, and that would hold people beyond the facts themselves, beyond, the trauma. If people are really into, trauma memoirs, I wanted it to be something more than that. So the fact that I feel like I pulled it off and I feel like it's been received that way is just, it feels the gratification and the gratitude that I have is just overwhelming.
And congrats. I understand it was selected Barnes & Noble nonfiction book of the month. That's got to be a win.
That's a win.
Yeah. And of course, a best audiobook of 2022 named by the New York Times. And I think Nylon described it as a page-turning memoir chronicling a woman's accidental descent into prescription benzodiazepine dependence. I hope I'm saying that properly. And the life-threatening impacts of long-term use that chills to the bone. And it really does. Such harrowing stuff to think about. But of course, this is not unusual in America, right? Overprescription of drugs that aren't, that we don't always necessarily know the long-term health effects of. But the New York Times had said, a word of caution, the author pulls you so far down her psychological rabbit hole that it can be difficult, emotionally speaking, to crawl back out. Not just a memoir, but also a chilling true crime story. We kind of experience it with you. And kudos on the work, of course. I can't wait to talk about what you are working on more recently. But talk a little bit about where you are now and what you're looking at in the future.
Well, it's interesting when you my memoir is the first national book, and it's so, I never thought I was going to write a memoir because, I'm naturally, I don't want to put myself out there. I've been more of a fiction writer and a poet. So it was shocking for me to have this life experience that when I reflected upon it, I was like, this is a memoir. Like, this is the kind of thing that you say, holy shit, you've got to write about that. So obviously I did, but what I'm really excited about now is the fiction that, I've been working on for years that I can now return to. And it's interesting because I thought, wow, is my editor going to want me to do some kind of follow on, how did you survive, things on wellness and health. And, while those are things that I am interested in and practice, my passion is really in creating fiction that is pretty different. I mean, I've been working on it, and it's a little, it's always weird to say the word experimental, but it's using forms that I haven't necessarily seen in the way that I'm doing it. I'm just playing around. But it also is infused with some of the themes that have been my life experience, which is the real fracture in the healthcare system, both the straight medical and the mental healthcare system in the United States. So that, weirdly enough, was part of the book. This was a book I began working on my early 20s. Late 20s. And it was part of that. And so it was really, really sort of weirdly premonitional that, is that a word, premonitional?
I like it.
It was a premonition, that I ended up kind of experiencing it in a really, really broad, intense way. And so I just have more information now. And I'm loving having the flexibility of the world of fiction, to do what I want with the characters. So that's what I'm working on now.
Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit more about your process, of course, now, and kind of the evolution of your writing process, and how your background in journalism probably kind of informs part of that work ethic. But talk a little bit about, I had just seen that you'd mentioned a book that had kind of helped you through that dark time, The Places That Scare You. And that's another one that I found incredibly insightful and important at a time, I think, when I was kind of at a low ebb myself. Yeah. But talk a little bit about that book and or, you know, others, but in particular, because some of the themes that I remember from that book seem resonant in the way that you talk about kind of transcending the trauma, et cetera.
Yeah. Well, I love that you picked up on, so The Places That Scare You is by the Buddhist nun Pema Chodron. And I have, from the time I was, you know, fairly young, I would say in my late teens, been really interested in Buddhist philosophies, and especially the practice of mindfulness and presence and acceptance. So Pema Chodron, there were a series of books that I took with me when I was, you know, sort of creating this personal made detox, because it had to go on for and kind of an indefinite amount of time. I was told by the addictionologist that I worked with that it could take me anywhere from 10 months to 2 years to get off the medication that I had taken, you know, just as my doctor prescribed. So this was a marathon. And I needed a kind of strength that would move beyond my personal will into something that was greater than me. So this is where my own personal philosophies of, you know, kind of the ancient Greeks, as well as the Buddhist philosophies of both sitting in absolute acceptance of the present moment, as well as being able to look beyond the self into kind of an ecstasy, the ecstasis, which is sitting beyond oneself into something bigger, and holding to that as your anchor. So both of those sort of philosophical and spiritual modalities or belief systems really were what helped me make it through a time in my life when I really wasn't sure if I was going to survive. And then also just the practice of writing stuff down or creating art. There was actually a period where I was so physically disabled, I couldn't write with a pen. I could type on the computer, but my eyes were so affected and my writing was so affected, you couldn't read it. So those two things really supported me in having a strength that went beyond personal will.
Yeah, I can't wait to just talk a little bit more about your writing process. Of course, I could pick your brain about the process of transcending the trauma all day, but let's talk about what is a good day for you now that you've kind of had your dark night of the soul and are in a place now where you're, you know, writing fiction? And are you a morning writer? Are you somebody who, you know, gets up and brews a pot of coffee and gets at it? Or are you a procrastinator like me?
Oh, you know, I am not a procrastinator, really. I think because there was something, I've developed a pretty disciplined practice for myself. And part of that is having, just doing all of the life stuff that we all have to do. You know, I have two kids. I've got to, you know, put on the sort of mama role to be able to make sure they get what they need. I have a full-time job. So that leaves these little windows. And I take those windows and I plan them out ahead of time. So in part, it's like throwing a line forward, like fishing, you know, like I'll throw the line forward. I know I'm going to have time to write these days. I'll have this certain number of hours. And that will begin the process of kind of simmering. It's almost like I'm getting you know, I'm mixing my metaphors like crazy here right now, Kelton, but I'm like, you know, getting ready to make a soup and I start simmering on what I'm going to be writing on. So in, for instance, if I'm working on my fiction piece, which the working title right now is Streamline Jenny, I will be thinking about what are the next movements for the characters? What are the problems that I'm encountering? What, you know, and then I'll even do, you know, some meditating and like different things for insight, because a lot of times, and I'll also, oh, this is a practice that I have. I journal every morning, just freeform. And a lot of times, first thing in the morning, I'll get these ideas that I didn't even know were inside of me. Like, oh, I know that the character of Simone needs to do this, or she's going to fall in love with so-and-so. And those things, once I've thrown that line out and I know that I'm going to be working like 4 hours on Saturday, or I'm going to have, you know, chunks, 2 hours every single day, that simmering process will begin, or that reeling in of the line, whatever metaphor really strikes you.
Yeah, the creative process takes many forms. And of course, that incubation period is super important. And I like the just kind of the free form, what is it, Kerouac's method.
It's Kerouac's method.
I'm blanking. Stream of consciousness. Sorry. Yeah. Sometimes stream of consciousness can get you there. Obviously, it's not always great writing, but of course, you rely on craft. And I think probably as a journalist and a poet, both makes for some super compelling prose.
Yeah. I mean, I think I have always thought in pictures. And so that really helps, I think, with the prose, because I see things visually so much. And I think the stream of consciousness is kind of like clearing off the desk. You know, you've got to like, you've got this messy desk and you've got all these ideas. And then you've also got kind of these to-do lists. And you've got to clear off the desk before you can really sit down with the book and get started.
Yeah, clearing off the desk. Absolutely. Setting the desk is important. Yeah, I got a fun one for you before we kind of wrap up with your advice to your fellow scribes. Of course, I will point to your home base there, where we can learn more, connect with you in all the socials, and that is melissaabond.com. And yeah, I was fascinated to read more about your bio, but of course the Poetry Slam piece is really, really cool. And I understand that you've even worked in radio, so I'm kind of doing some experimental stuff there too, right?
Yeah, that was really fun. I was totally like under the radar. A friend of mine was doing these 5-minute shorts on our local radio station, fiction shorts, and he was like, hey, come with me and you can start doing this too. And we kind of bypassed the typical like training thing that you're supposed to do. And we would just go in late at night and like I would record these 5-minute fictional shorts. And we finally got in trouble, but they really liked what we were doing.
You got in trouble.
We got in trouble because they were like, wait a minute, who's this Melissa Bond? Like, she's never been through our training and she's creating these fictional shorts in our studio at like 11 o'clock at night.
Amazing. That's so cool. Such a cool story. Blood Orange Night, of course, a memoir of insomnia, motherhood, and benzos. Yeah, looking forward to rapping with you in the future about some fiction stuff. But yeah, I got a fun one for you. If you could have drinks and or dinner with any author from any era, who would you take and where are we going?
Oh my gosh. Oh, and where are we going? Okay, so I'm going to, the first thing that comes initially is from this era, Margaret Atwood. Her mind just blows me away. I would love to talk with her because it's so prescient right now. But she's been writing along that line, Ursula K. Le Guin. I think some of, you know, the her musings on the social structure that kind of is killing us is really interesting. But then I also, where would we go? I would take them both on a picnic far, far away from here. And I would have the most divine picnic in a beautiful meadow, kind of, in a beautiful grassy meadow with no one else around.
Oh, perfect.
And then, you know, I keep thinking, one of the mystic poets I would love to hang out with, Hafiz, probably in like a tavern somewhere.
Oh, it's, I love it. It's a two-parter.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. All right. In a tavern, what are we drinking?
Let's see. I would get Hafiz anything that he wanted, and I would, what would I drink? I would probably drink some kind of mead. I would want something that they had, but some kind of mead.
Mead. Okay. love it. This is all new to me. So, a truly original two-part date, with both the fabulous Margaret Atwood, Ursula Le Guin, and then a mystic poet in a tavern with some mead. Love it. Very cool. Well, thank you, Melissa. We really appreciate your words, your wisdom, taking the time to wrap with us today. Oh, I was going to say, as a goofy aside, Margaret Atwood retweeted me once. It's like a highlight of my life
because
I had interviewed the creator of the fantastic adaptation, most recent adaptation of The Handmaid's Tale.
Oh my gosh.
And so he came on the show and we rapped, and of course I tweeted about it and she retweeted it, and it was
my heart would have stopped, Kelton. Honestly.
I think it did for a moment. It was definitely skipped a beat.
So cool.
I would love to just get your final pearl of wisdom, any advice you may have to just your fellow scribes on how to keep going in a nutshell. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think what I would say, the thing that I see so often with writers and that I struggled with for years is that gnome that can be a monster of self-doubt. You know, that question of, am I good enough, or do I really have something unique to write? And what I would say is, you acknowledge that gnome of self-doubt, you give it a cookie and you ask it to please sit in the corner, because everyone has just absolute beauty and a gem inside of them. And if you can put that aside, what comes out of you is just incredible. And just keep working and trusting that you will hit your stride, you know, and it just takes setting that self-doubt aside and trusting that the work is finding you.
I love that so much. Such a great place to end up, and putting self-doubt aside is something that we can always remember. And again, congrats on the work. Really look forward to reading more of your work. And this experimental fiction sounds really cool. So hopefully we'll get to wrap again, but thank you for your time today.
Oh, total pleasure, Kelton. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for joining us for this file. And if you're a fan of the show, simply head over to writerfiles.fm for more. That's writerfiles.fm.